This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Wednesday, June 3rd, 2020. I'm Caleb Brown. The president has promised, or threatened, depending on how you look at it, to use the military to put down protests in American cities. Those protests, of course, are against abusive tactics used by police. So under what circumstances is that legal or constitutional? All of this comes as some members of Congress are asking the president to go much further and treat Americans like enemies on a battlefield. Cato's Gene Healy comments. In many American cities, there is a lot of dissatisfaction with police, and many cities have suffered enormous property damage. Some people have been killed by police, and the president has essentially said that if mayors and governors are not able to solve this problem, he will solve it for them using the U.S. military. So walk us through the circumstances under which the president can do that.
Sure. Well, ordinarily, he can't. We have something called the Posse Comitatus Act that you and I have talked about on this podcast before. It's nearly 150 years old. It's a federal statute that makes it a criminal offense to use the U.S. military, use U.S. military forces to, quote unquote, execute the laws. The basic idea is you don't want to put soldiers in a, you don't want to turn the U.S. military inward. You don't want to put soldiers in a policing situation. That's something that we've, had a longstanding distrust for, predates the the Constitution. We've always had a fear of standing armies being used at home, but the Posse Comitatus Act isn't a comprehensive ban. It says, the statute itself says, that where Congress has expressly authorized the use of federal troops as a police force, that it doesn't implicate the, it's not a criminal offense. It doesn't implicate the Posse Comitatus Act. And you have another longstanding series of statutes that, which really go back to, in some form, back to the Washington administration. These are the Insurrection Acts, and they're based on the constitutional power to for Congress to provide for calling forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. And ordinarily, in normal circumstances, you would have, under the Insurrection Acts, a request from a state governor. We've had an uprising or domestic violence to the extent that the state's forces can't handle it. That's ordinarily what would happen, but that's not always what happens. There are two provisions of the Insurrection Acts that allow the president to send in U.S. military forces without, and even over the objection of state governors. Under one, if the president believes that unlawful combinations and assemblages make it impractical to enforce federal law in the state, he can use such of the armed forces as he thinks are necessary to enforce the laws. Under another, the president can suppress insurrection or conspiracy if it hinders the execution of laws, such that any part or class of the state's people are deprived of constitutional rights. And each of these provisions have been used in, not in the recent past, but one of them was invoked by President Eisenhower in 1957 to enforce the integration of Little Rock Central High in Arkansas. JFK used another provision several times, once in Alabama to enforce desegregation orders. And the governors in those occasions, Orville Faubus and George Wallace, didn't invite Ike or JFK to send federal troops to Little Rock or Birmingham. So it's not unprecedented to use these provisions of the Insurrection Act that don't depend upon a request from the state governor, but it is exceedingly rare. And in recent decades, use of the Insurrection Act, well, it's been nearly 30 years since the Insurrection Act was invoked and U.S. troops were used to put down domestic violence on American soil in the first place. The last time was in the 1992 L.A. riots after the acquittal of the officers who beat up Rodney King. But that's the last time that the U.S. military active duty federal troops have been used in a domestic peacekeeping situation on the soil of the United States.
There are members of Congress, I think most notably Tom Cotton, who are urging the president to actually go much further than that.
Right. Yeah, Tom Cotton, sometimes more rabid than the president himself, the Arkansas senator. The other day started tweeting about how, let's see how tough these Antifa terrorists are when they're facing off with the 101st Airborne. They should show them no quarter. Similar statement from current Secretary of Defense, Mark Esper, who in a conference call with the state governors urged them to, quote, dominate the battle space. In other words, our American city streets. This is not the kind of talk you want to hear in a country that, rightly distrusts the use of standing armies at home or has had a long tradition of that. As little sympathy as I have for anyone in Antifa, turning the 101st Airborne loose on American city streets is a very bad idea. It's something you want to be an absolute last resort. You don't want them to be first responders. The kind of as somebody once put it, the military is trained to vaporize, not Mirandize. The type of training that makes U.S. forces effective warfighters is something that's hard to switch off, can be hard to switch off in a domestic peacekeeping situation. The National Guard is slightly different. They have gotten, they tend to get more training in crowd control, in non-lethal uses of force, particularly after the Kent State shootings. But the 101st Airborne is not something that you want to use for, keeping the peace domestically. We've crossed that line before, we've come to regret it. It was a few years after the LA riots. We had on the border, we had a Marine Corps anti-drug patrol that wasn't supposed to be actually enforcing. It was a support role. This is 1997. A couple of Marines shot and killed an 18-year-old American high school student who was herding goats near his family's farm in Redford, Texas. And later on, an internal Pentagon investigation of that incident said that the soldiers weren't really trained for this kind of contact with civilians because the Marines' military training had instilled, quote, an aggressive spirit while teaching basic combat skills. And that's exactly what you want if you're fighting a war. That's what you want in Marines. But it's not something you want to mix with a law enforcement function. And that's one of the reasons we have the Posse Comitatus Act.
It seems clear that a lot of this would be done over the objections of governors, of mayors, perhaps even of chiefs of police around the country. What might this actually look like?
Well, I think it's going to be very difficult for an objecting state governor to really throw a spanner in the works here. You can rightfully argue that the situation we're talking about here doesn't look like Little Rock in 1957. It doesn't look like Birmingham, in the Kennedy administration. But I think those arguments will only get you so far. The insurrection acts do recognize that the president can, on occasion, send in federal troops to execute the laws, even over the objection of a state governor. So I think, as a practical matter, there's not much that can stop this from happening. You would like to see that, you know, if it does happen, the U.S. military is very aware of the dangers of mixing policing and warfighting functions. So you would hope to see more of a reliance on military police units. You would hope to see more of a support role. That's sometimes what has happened in these incidents, where there's just a show of force and not direct hands-on engagement with protesters and rioters and looters. But it's something that, you know, should really be avoided as anything but a last resort. If you think Donald Trump's tweets have been fueling the fire over the past week or so, this is a real step up the escalation ladder. And we want to be very careful of anything, with apologies to Secretary of Defense Esper, we want to be very wary of anything that starts treating U.S. city streets as quote-unquote battle space.
Gene Healy is a vice president at the Cato Institute and author of The Cult of the Presidency. Subscribe to the Cato Daily Podcast wherever you please and follow us on Twitter @CatoPodcast.